Hey gang, welcome to another exciting episode, and we are back to our regular schedule with Filbert Financial Friday, recorded on Thursday night, late on Thursday night. Actually, we could call this Friday. I think it's, we could call it Friday. How are you doing, Filbert?
Feel pretty good.
All right, good. So, just before we get going with the Russia stuff and the financial stuff, we've both been looking at some videos lately, and you were telling me that you were watching a video last night. I was watching a video on, I guess it was Vice TV, and it was a whole hit story on Chris Cantwell in Charlottesville. What were you watching?
I was watching something on the Aryan Brotherhood, and I was also watching something about the Aryan Army, or what was it, the Aryan Republic Army, or the ARA.
And who do you think directed it?
Probably Abe Foxman.
isn't it Jeff Greenblatt now? I think he's taken over. Taken over the ADL.
Maybe it was Harvey Weinstein.
It could be. He needs work. And I also was watching something this morning, and this I caught on a, I guess it's a Daily Stormer, at the bottom of one of the Daily Stormers page. And it was on Steven Spielberg had it back in the 1990s. He had this project where he went out and he sought survivors of the Holocaust, and he interviewed them, or he didn't personally, but he sent out people to their homes and they interviewed them. I know somebody who got interviewed. I'm one of these days planned to go see what she told them, because she wasn't the type of person who was going to lie about anything if it wasn't going to personally profit her. So I'd like to see what she has to say. But, of course, you know, out of these tens of thousands of people, they cherry-picked a few who talked about really horrible circumstances and put that out to the public. But the video I saw that Daily Stormer linked to was other people have gone in, because this is like there's an archive, and I guess you can go in and look. And There are people who are talking about their soccer games and their orchestras at Auschwitz, and you know, presenting kind of a different side of it. Not that it was a luxury resort, but that it had certain features that one might not expect of a death camp. So, but the big news, of course, this past week has been the big meeting between great leader Donald Trump and fearless leader Vladimir Putin. Did you follow that at all, Filbert?
No, I didn't see that at all. No. I missed every single bit of it.
Completely missed.
But luckily, I tuned into Stormfront, so I got to hear you describe it, what was happening.
Yeah. So, I mean, it was what I've been waiting for a long time. I thought Donald Trump was going to be elected. I didn't think Hillary was going to be elected. I thought she was too weak. The thing that surprised me was that it was as close as it was, and that was a very, very, very close election. It really could have gone either way. So
if he is impeached, mm-hmm. Do you think that he'll be removed, that they'll be able to get him out?
Yes. So the impeachment takes place in the House of Representatives, and it's actually a much lower threshold than removing him. They simply need a majority. If the Democrats were to win the midterm elections this November, win big enough that they took control of the House of Representatives, I think you would almost certainly find impeachment on the table. Of course, Bill Clinton was impeached. He was not removed from office. Removing from office means that the Senate has to convict you with a two-thirds majority. And there's no way that the Democrats are going to come out of the midterm elections with a two-thirds majority. Even if they have good elections, the fact of the matter is that in the Senate, elections are every 6 years. So the people who are running for re-election in the Senate this year, or the people whose terms are expiring this year, were the people who were elected in 2012. What was 2012? That was Barack Obama's re-election year. So it's the senators who were elected when Barack Obama won re-election, and that was a pretty strong re-election. And that was a big Democratic victory that year. It's a lot of Democrats who are up for re-election, or Democrats who are retiring. But the most of the seats being defended, I can't remember the exact breakdown, but the significant majority are Democratic seats. So even if the Democrats are able to maintain control of the 20 something or whatever it is, it's a breakdown like 22 to 11 or 21 to 12, it's something like that. Even if they were to maintain control over all the seats that they that are up for re-election that they currently have, which would be a significant majority of the seats up for re-election, they're still not going to take control of the Senate, let alone two-thirds. So the actual removing of Donald Trump from office is necessarily would require large numbers of Republicans defecting. Could that happen? Yeah. I mean, it could happen, because the Republicans in Congress have shown a propensity to be willing to betray Donald Trump, to abandon him, as they did in October when that Access Hollywood tape was released of him saying if one has celebrity status, then hypothetically one could grab women by certain body parts. He wasn't saying he ever did it. Maybe he did do it. But he was saying you can do it. It can be done when you're a celebrity. Whether he's actually tested that theory or not, I don't know, and I don't care. So Trump getting removed from office would depend on a big election victory for the for the Democrats in the midterms, which those prospects seem to be fading, and on some sort of scandal or something that would give the Republicans in the Senate enough of an excuse to betray him, which is not unthinkable. And you think of, I think back to 1974, when, in 1972, Richard Nixon won re-election by a massive landslide. 49 out of 50 states voted for Richard Nixon. And yet, a year and a half later, a little more than a year and a half later, he was forced from office. He would have been impeached, but he resigned before he... he would have been impeached, but he resigned before that happened, when his people surveyed the senators and the Republicans in the Senate and figured out that enough of them were going to abandon the president over the Watergate cover-up that he was going to be pushed from office. And he was unpopular. He'd become unpopular because of the Vietnam War, which had already pretty much wound down, but he was unpopular among a lot of people.
I am not a crook.
Yeah, not a crook.
He wasn't perfect, but we can thank him for removing our gold standard from our currency in 1971, and he said it was temporary. He was temporarily instructing the Secretary of the Treasury to, take the actions necessary to defend the dollar against the speculator. I got a speculator.
Yeah, I was...
I'm sure you've seen that speech.
Not that particular speech. I was very anti-Nixon, and as a kid, I'd gone and I'd, stuffed envelopes, which was a common way of working for candidates. You'd go stuff envelopes for mailings. I stuffed envelopes for George McGovern. And why? Because George McGovern in 1972 was saying, just let's end the as opposed to President Nixon's secret plan to end the war that he had talked about in 4 years earlier, McGovern had his public plan to end the war. He was just going to end the war, just going to pull out. And that was the big thing for me, because I didn't understand a lot of things, but that was the big thing for me, was the war, and for a lot of other people. And it's hard to say how Nixon lost so much popularity, and people will talk about Walter Cronkite and the Zionist press, which had their, Jews had their own problems with Nixon, and Nixon knew he knew about Jewish power, and that's all clear now. How clear was it back then, before the internet? I don't know. And of course, you got to figure in 1973, less than a year before he was pushed from office, what did he do? He risked World War III to airlift weapons to Israel during the 1973 Yom Kippur War, when the Syria and Egypt had attacked Israel in order to take back land that Israel had stolen from them when Israel attacked those countries in 1967, 6 years earlier. And there was a real threat that if the United States intervened in such a way that it would provoke a World War III, because Egypt was at the time a client state, and I suppose Syria as well, a client state of the Soviet Union, and the Soviets had warned the United States against intervening. Well, this airlift of weaponry, they got away with it, and it allowed Israel to once again take back the territories that they had seized in 1967.
And more, too.
I don't think that it was in 1967, they had seized the Sinai, the Golan, and the West Bank.
Jerusalem, wasn't it?
Hmm?
And Jerusalem, too, right?
And Jerusalem. And that was in 67. And then in the first week or so of the Yom Kippur War, I don't know the day-by-day breakdown of how things went, but most of that had been taken back in the very beginning of the Yom Kippur War. But with the help of this airlift, Israel was able to seize back the territory and go back to the land that it occupied, that it seized in 67. It was able to restore its 1967 conquest. And what thanks did Nixon get? He got pushed out of office. So,
boy, if we could just cut their funding, it seems like, because all this military hardware we send them, just it's high maintenance,
Yeah.
Not to mention that, they're probably not even smart enough to upkeep it, So it just seems to me like if we could cut the money supply off from the international drug trade and just, financial aid and military aid all combined, that would be enough just to cut the head off of the snake. I don't know. What do you think?
Well, there are a lot of smart Israelis, but what else there are is an awful lot of Israelis who just spend their time, these ultra-Orthodox Jews, who just spend their time reading the Talmud and the Torah to an extent, but the Talmud. They just sit and read and don't work. And they might send their wives off to do some work, but largely live off welfare from the Israeli state, which is possible because of the massive foreign aid that they can count on from the United States and Germany. If that foreign aid was cut off, I'm not saying the Israeli state would collapse, because those Israelis who do work, they've built up all sorts of businesses where they've insinuated themselves into, for instance, all the medical record keeping for America, and when I say all, I don't mean all, but a big hunk of it, the billing for telecommunications companies, which happens also have the benefit of giving them you know, metadata on all of our phone calls and all of our communications. You know, all sorts of stuff. The credit card processing. They've gotten into all sorts of things. So they can actually, even without the aid, they could probably, you know, they'd have to do some belt tightening. Maybe it would cause big problems for them. But by now, after 60 or 70 years, especially the past 50 years of the aid they've gotten from the United States and, you know, what they get from Germany, they've been able to invest that in all sorts of things, you know, not just weaponry, but these businesses that are going to make them money and also give them valuable information. So I don't know. We have a lot of work to do there. So sometimes I wonder, maybe, you know, Trump did not, he doesn't want to take on the Israel lobby first. He wants to take on other aspects of Jewish power. But
like the media, that's a good choice too, I think.
Well, you know, if you try to disambiguate the Jews, ambiguate, is that it? Disaggregate. If you try to disaggregate them, so you're not taught, and they're not necessarily a monolith, then you have to say, well, what do I take on first? And he's not taking on Wall Street, and he's not taking on the Israel lobby, but he is taking on the immigration lobby, and he is taking on the press.
Yeah.
And
one thing one might argue in, say, financial, like the Federal Reserve, and I would just point out that Henry Ford was quoted as saying that he thought that if everybody in the United States knew how the monetary system worked, then it wouldn't last another day. And, I mean, that just goes to show the power of the media, and I agree with him. If we had a media that wasn't a Zionist media, I think it'd be a lot, our tasks would be a lot easier.
Mm-hmm. Now, by the way, President Trump was interviewed, I can't remember who the interviewer was, but over the past day or so, and he was talking about Jerome Powell, his non-Jewish appointed head of the Fed.
Yeah, first in 30 years. Or
yeah.
30 plus years.
Yeah, and he was saying he thinks he picked a good man and everything, but he was kind of pushing back at the interest rate hikes, which I guess you would expect him to, because he is trying to, you know, get the economy booming and the stock market booming, which is, I guess, good for his reelection or his midterm elections, and feels that the rate hikes that that Jerome Powell has been continuing, the slow 0.25% rate hikes every 3 to 6 months, are an obstacle. So he was pushing back at that.
Well, he's right. And here's why I think that's true. Simply because for the stock market to flourish the way he wants it to, it is flourishing to a certain extent, but if he wants it higher, you have to have a weaker dollar. And, you know, raising interest rates doesn't attract, you know, bond buyers, or people in institutions that are buying bonds.
And so the higher the rates go, the higher cost of of borrowing for companies.
Right,
so
well, the more dollars are bought around the world, and thus the dollar gets stronger, and stocks tend to, you know, I mean, I'm not saying that they do bad, but they tend to, they do better when the dollar's weaker. We also export more when the dollar's weaker, too. I've heard Gerald Celente touch on that.
Right, that's right. And let's talk about that when we come back from the break.
Okay. We'll be right back.
welcome back to the show. So we were just talking about Donald Trump pushing back against the interest rates, the higher interest rates. And you were making the point that the higher interest rates tend to push up the value of the dollar, to appreciate the dollar. And we've certainly seen the dollar strengthen somewhat over the past couple of months against the yen, for instance. How's it going against some of the other currencies?
All the majors, like the Kiwi and the Aussie and even the Swiss franc, it's been winning over all of them. And I'm surprised over that. In fact, I've lost some money over that. And I really thought it would have been weaker than it is now.
Yeah. And I'm tend to be perpetually bearish on the dollar in my long-term view, maybe short-term.
Who knows? You're right. It is a dying asset.
I've tended to be like that perpetually, and you know, if you look over the decades, it certainly over the decades has weakened against a lot of currencies. We'll see. Now, regarding the Helsinki summit, I've been waiting ever since Trump was elected, and even before he was elected, because I thought he was going to get elected. I've been thinking that it was going to lead to an end of sanctions on Russia, and the Russian economy, I think during the era of sanctions, the Russian economy has actually restructured quite a bit, that with a lessened ability to earn money overseas through exporting energy and whatnot, and which also has to do with lower energy prices, that Putin had been clamping down on importing non-essential consumer goods, and instead Russia has been building up its own domestic industries during this period of sanctions, which is probably made the economy stronger. And so I've been expecting the Russian stock market to take off. And it hasn't, but it's, of course, because the sanctions haven't ended. And, you know, they continued, and relations with Russia, instead of getting better, got worse. The Russian stocks, at least the various exchange-traded funds that are available in the United States, really have not declined in value. One might have expected them to decline in value quite a bit, given the deterioration of relations between the United States and Russia over the past 18 months. They didn't really decline, but they didn't pick up. And even in this past few days, these past trading sessions since the summit, it's not as if there's been any kind of spike in the value of these ETFs. I'm not sure when it's going to come through. I do expect sooner or later for there to be a big improvement in the Russian stock market. But so far it hasn't happened yet. And I guess, how about this week? Why wasn't there a spike this week? Because Putin and Trump seem to have a very, very good summit. And they were talking about economic issues. They were talking about energy exports and gas and whatnot. But I guess the markets have reacted to the political reaction against Trump from both parties. I mean, you've got Democrats saying that it's treason, which is a capital offense, by the way, basically saying that President Bush not only should he be removed from office, but he should be executed and killed, right? Or Steve Cohen, not my Professor Stephen F. Cohen, but Representative Steve Cohen of Tennessee, basically saying that where's the military? Which one could assume means, why isn't the military overthrowing him in a military coup? They've gone pretty extreme
I can tell you why if you want.
Tell me why.
It's because they get paid in dollars. It's like, well, why didn't the Roman soldiers overthrow Caesar? No.
Because they get paid in salt?
I don't know what they got paid in. Probably real silver, wouldn't it?
Well, there were periods at least where they were getting paid in salt. And salt is sal, I guess sal in Latin. And that's where salary comes from, sal.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
I learn something every day.
You do learn something.
I don't mean to get off topic, but the one journalist said something kind of funny. There were a bunch of cops around, and he goes, look at all those Federal Reserve police. And somebody else goes, where? And he goes, look, all of them right there. And he goes, the other one goes, there is no such thing as Federal Reserve police. And the journalist goes, yeah, who do you think pays them? You know?
Yeah, so. Well, they get paid in greenbacks, Federal Reserve notes.
That's right. Hmm.
So
I mean, that.
How many of them think in those terms, of course?
Well, it just doesn't allow any kind of alternative, you know, I mean.
Well, I mean, the point is that, of course, they're working for money.
Right.
Okay, well, we will be back after this next break. To the show. So just before the break, we were kind of... Well, I'd mentioned Representative Steve Cohen, not to be confused with Professor Stephen F. Cohen, who I frequently talk about, especially with regards to Russia, because he's a Russia expert. And if you watch Tucker Carlson, you saw him a couple of times this week on Tucker Carlson's show. And if you have access to HBO, I guess, what was it? Vice TV? Had an interview with Professor Stephen F. Cohen and Professor John Mearsheimer, who were talking about why we need good relations with Russia and why the whole Russia hoax is a hoax and things like that. I don't have access to HBO, but I did see the 5-minute teaser for it. It looks quite interesting, so I'm recommending that. But Steve, Representative Steve Cohen, apparently calling for a military coup. We don't have a history of military coups in this country, but certainly in other countries there are. Do you have any feelings about that? Why don't we have the history of military coups here, for instance?
Well, it just dawned on me. I don't think there's been a whole lot, and you're way better and more scholarly on history than I am, of course, but I don't believe there's been a lot of military coups in Great Britain either. And the one correlation I can see is that throughout history, we both had very well-disciplined militaries.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that could be one reason why. And, well, the Romans as well, go back further. Main reason I think why, and the current reason, is the money. Like I said, monetary. They get paid in dollars. But it just seems like to me, you know, some people in the military, you know, are... fairly intelligent, you know, you have to be at least fairly intelligent to get in. But I'm surprised we haven't seen any, or virtually any, you know, whether it's, you know, not for money, but, you know, just for a cause or anything. I'm not encouraging violence. I don't promote violence at all, but like I said, I'm just surprised I haven't seen any, or we haven't seen much.
Well, we talked about Nixon earlier, and we've never had a president removed from office by impeachment. We've had 4 removed from office by assassination, and there are certainly people who would look at the Kennedy assassination and say, well, you know, the CIA did it or something like that. And so we'll have to leave that aside. The only president who wound up being pushed out of office was Nixon, who I mentioned earlier.
It was before he was going to get impeached, right?
He thought he was going to be impeached, and rather than being impeached, he just threw in the towel.
Yeah, and won't even go through it.
Yeah, and, you know, there may have been a little bit of a quid pro quo with Vice President Ford, whom he had just appointed, because Vice President Spiro Agnew, who had been his running mate in both 1968 and 72, had resigned from the vice presidency corruption charges dating back from when he was governor of Maryland and I guess was getting kickbacks from a racetrack. So the seat had been vacant, and what is that, the 25th Amendment to the Constitution that allows, in case of a vacancy... this was passed in, I guess, the 1960s, I think, after the Kennedy assassination. If there's a vacancy, it allows the president of the United States to appoint a vice president who then has to be ratified by Senate. And so Ford had been appointed just the year earlier. And there may well have been a quid pro quo where Ford said that he would pardon Nixon. That may well have happened.
Yeah, and that pardon came, I don't know.
Within a few weeks. I think, yep. I'm trying to remember, did Nixon resign in July or did he resign in August? But it was within a few weeks. I have a feeling Nixon resigned at the beginning of July or like around July 10th or 11th. Somebody can check it. And within about 3 weeks, he had been pardoned. And the Pardon was more or less at the same time as the Pardon. It might have even been announced the same day, certainly the same week. There was also a clemency offer to draft dodgers. Not Pardon, but clemency, something. There was some sort of offer to the draft dodgers. And I was mentioning that I thought that Nixon's continuation of the Vietnam War longer than it needed to be continued. It should have been shut down right away, really. That there was a lot of animosity towards Nixon over that. And lots of people had avoided the war because there was a draft. They had avoided the draft by going to Canada. And a pardon over the draft dodging would have allowed these people to come back. The clemency offer was a little more complicated. As I recall, it involved community service and things, and it was a bit more complicated. Whereas Nixon just got a pardon. Any crimes he may have been committed, he wouldn't be prosecuted for. And when Ford came in those first 3 weeks, he was very popular. He was very popular the first 3 weeks because he hadn't been that much of a national figure. He had been... he had been the House Minority Leader during a period where the Democrats had a very, very substantial and seemingly permanent majority in the House of Representatives. He had been a Minority Leader, so it's not as if he was unknown. But he wasn't a big deal, and you know, he was known for making his own breakfast in the morning, you know, and then commuting to work, which was a House Minority Leader would do that. I don't know if Nancy Pelosi makes her own breakfast, but Gerald Ford did. Wouldn't wake up his wife, who actually was an alcoholic, as it turned out, but it, you know, he'd make his own toast and eggs and go off in the morning. And so there, he was kind of popular the first 3 weeks, and then all of a sudden he pardons Nixon, doesn't pardon the draft dodgers, and next thing you know, Saturday Night Live with... Chevy Chase, they just started lampooning him mercilessly. So, if you want to, it was kind of funny. You can go back and actually Chevy Chase, I think, permanently injured himself by all the stunts he did because it was very physical humor. He'd always have Ford falling on his back, and I think he injured his own back so much that he wound up getting addicted to painkillers. So, oh well, that's a lot of history there. But
oh, the irony.
The point I was actually getting at was it did not seem that the military had any role in pushing Nixon out of office. So we don't have a tradition of the military pushing leaders out of office. And even when you don't have military coups, sometimes if you look around at other countries, you do have military people maneuvering that leads to civilian presidents leaving and new civilian presidents coming or what have you. And you don't have that tradition here. What does that mean without the tradition? Does that mean that the people would probably not want to accept it and therefore they hold back on it? Does it mean that they don't have the practice? They don't have the institutional knowledge of how to play that kind of politics? I don't know. Do you have any feelings on that?
And I may be wrong, like I am on most things, but I kind of think that it's because, especially in the West, you know, we grow up being led around like a pet dog. And we're just kind of being told what to do. And the money, you know. Everybody's afraid of either being called a racist or, you know, losing your source of income. And that's a legitimate fear, losing your source of income. It's a lot worse than being called a racist.
Mm-hmm. Well, your point about the money is probably a very good point. Because we've had a very stable monetary system here, and the military's paid in cash. You know, there's other perks, but they're paid in cash.
And they're paid. I mean, I'm not.
They paid pretty well.
Say well, but one thing you can guarantee, at least in the United States, if you're in the military, you get a raise every year.
Yeah, they're paid pretty well, and especially if you're talking about interfering in politics, it's not going to be corporals and sergeants interfering in politics. I mean, you would think of generals, or at least you would think of, you know, colonels and lieutenant colonels. And these people are paid very well. They're paid very, very well. And, you know, if you're an officer, even, you know, lieutenant, and you're planning on doing your 20 years, you do 20 years, you're in your early 40s, you get out, you're getting your full pension, and then you can typically go and work for some K Street company, Beltway Bandit company, and people do very well. It's there.
Yeah, like the more I look at it, it seems like, you know, expect like the bankers like have all the they have all the power. Like, yeah, all the power isn't in the military, is it? Like a general, you know, that's very prestige. You know, the Duke of Ellington, you know, used to be your way to, you know, be able to rule. You know, mm-hmm. Not anymore. You know, you want to rule, become a banker.
Well, and then there's, if you're thinking about politically ambitious generals, we have a history of electing generals to be president. We also have a history of using generals for other important positions in government. So we have a Secretary of Defense who is a general, a recent general. The Chief of Staff at the White House, Kelly, is a general. So you've had plenty of generals. McMaster, as until recently foreign policy advisor, the national security advisor, general. Eisenhower was a general. And generals run for president. You think of, what was the guy's name, Wesley Clark, who's actually the son of an Orthodox rabbi.
Oh, Oy vey.
Oy vey, who was adopted away. I mean, I don't know what happened with the Orthodox rabbi, but he didn't raise Clark. Clark wound up being his mother. I don't know if they would divorce the rabbi or what, but
I think he hurt himself waving a chicken above his head.
Probably, because that's a occupational hazard there.
I think the chicken won that battle.
Yeah, well, and we could talk about chicken hawks and all sorts of things if we wanted to, but so we don't have that tradition here. And we do have a tradition of presidents filling out their terms, but we're in very unusual times. Think back to the, how about the breakup of the Soviet Union, and the military did play a role there. Not necessarily a victorious role, but there was the putsch in August 1991, where it was a day before Gorbachev was going to convene a meeting with the heads of most but not all of the constituent republics of the Soviet Union to sign a new union treaty. It would be a new treaty that would devolve power away from the union government that Gorbachev himself headed, and give much more autonomy to the various republics who were demanding autonomy and in some cases independence. It was a way to keep the Soviet Union in place. It would have had a name change, but a slight name change, but it would keep the union in place but change the way it governed itself. And there were so-called hardliners, including the military, that opposed that and thought Gorbachev was giving away too much, and they surrounded his private retreat, his dacha. Was that on the I think that was on the Crimean Peninsula, now that I recall. They surrounded it and cut off his communications and broadcast to the country that he had submitted his resignation, and his vice president, who was allied with the military, was taking over. And this led people in Moscow and some other cities to come out. And the president, and may I say the elected president, popularly elected president of the Russian Federation, one of the main constituent republic of the Soviet Union, people rallied around him, Boris Yeltsin. He stood on a tank. He stood on a tank and addressed the crowd. And so the military wound up backing down, and Gorbachev wound up being released from this house arrest that he was effectively under, but never regained power, and the Soviet Union fell apart within a matter of months. So you think the military did have a role there. Why was the Soviet military prepared to act when the Americans aren't? And you were talking about, well, the Americans are paid, and the Soviets were paid, but they were paid in rubles, and the ruble was losing its value. And right. So why would, you know, if you're being paid in a currency that is becoming worthless, or looks like it may become worthless, you're a military person, well, you're not, that sense of being paid, the loyalty that comes from being paid, that dries up pretty fast, doesn't it?
Yeah, and it makes you pretty angry. And, you know, if you're in the military and used to fighting and, you know, shooting and, you know, whatever else, or you may have done in the military, you get bored and want to do it, you know, so.
Get bored and want to do it. Yeah, ready for action. That's very possible. So you look around, and I've never done this, but I bet, and if anybody out there is a graduate student, you might want to do this. Look at cases of military coups, and then look at the monetary system. Because I think you have a good point, Filbert.
It may be strongly correlated.
It may well be strongly correlated, because a lot of other occupations, if the currency is losing its value, they can they have something to fall back on, you know, or they can raise their own prices. If you're in commerce, you can raise your prices to make up for things. But
if the currency is still strong, they still have their power, like they still have that stranglehold. You're still a debt slave.
Right. Okay, we'll be back after the break.
allow me to say that.
Okay, say it. We are back. We are back. What are you going to say?
Cuckoo the Jew.
Cuckoo the Jew. That sounds like a Beatles song. I Am the Walrus.
Cuckoo the Jew.
I think, is that what Paul McCartney was saying?
No, it was
Cuckoo the Jew, Cuckoo the Jew.
Cuckoo Kaju, K-A.
Cuckoo Kaju. Okay, well, it's pretty close.
Not so, too far off.
Just not too far off. Paul McCartney might have known a thing or two here and there. Or not. At any rate, what we have been facing, what I have been calling the Jew d'etat, which is this ongoing attempt to either remove President Trump from office or make him strip away his powers, ignore his powers, what do you call it, emasculate him. And so far they've been pretty successful in emasculating him, but I think this summer, with the aid of Kim Jong-un and Vladimir Putin, but really Kim Jong-un to a very large extent, he's been able to kind of emerge, and it's emboldened him, and he's taking action on the border, on immigration. We'll see. Is he finally going to be able to govern as a president? We'll see. And we've been talking about military coups. Well, why would the... if you were, let's say, and I don't think there is one leader of the Jewish people, right? But I do think that the Jews, and I don't even think that the Council of Presidents, you can seat every Jewish power in the Council of Presidents of major Jewish organizations or in the government of Israel. I think Jewish power is diffuse. It's very strong, but it's not centralized. But if you were a Jewish power broker, would you really want to, as your vehicle of a coup d'etat, would you really want to use the institution of the military, the one institution in the United States that probably has the least penetration of Jews, right? Would you really want to use it? I remember, the last thing I'll say is Senator Al Franken, before he was senator, I think, when he was just a comedian, or was writing books. He used to write books that lampooned Rush Limbaugh and other people. And he wrote a book, and he was saying, look, the military, the highest-ranking Jew in the military was like the commandant of the Coast Guard or something like that. It's a particularly goyish institution. If you're going to have a coup d'etat, is that what you're going to use? And that's my question.
I guess so. I mean, if life were like a game of Risk, which it kind of is, I guess, if everybody's a world president.
Well, you look at what they've been using. What have they been using, let's brainstorm some, for their Jew d'etat? I mean, the judiciary, quite a bit, right?
Oh, the Jews against us?
Yeah, the Jews against Trump, for instance, in the Jew d'etat.
The media, number one, and
the media, okay, number one,
monetary system.
Okay, media, number one. And then you're saying the monetary system.
Yeah,
and
it didn't used to be that way. I mean, it used to, the monetary system obviously came first before, instant 24/7 Fox News and CNN, Communist News Network.
Yeah, and you've got the judiciary, and of course the judges who have been issuing the rulings have typically, they've used a lot of Asians, but the judiciary is a very heavily Jewish influenced institution.
Yeah, the Supreme Court comes into play, and they say that's the most powerful office.
And it's been very noteworthy, because you were talking about the financial branch as well, these big appointments that Trump has made through the Supreme Court. His two picks have been goy. Obama's two picks, you had Kagan, who's a Jew, and Sotomayor, some people think is a crypto Jew. Clinton, his two picks were Jews. And all three of those people, including Bush, always appointed Jewish Fed chiefs and Trump didn't. So and I think that's very significant. Okay, well, this has been a fun show, Philbert. I'm glad we got back on schedule. Can I have you back again next week?
Yeah, absolutely. Glad to be here again.
Okay, so until then, I will be back again next week with more exciting episodes of National People Radio.